Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I have heard rumors all over town. They say that you're planning to put me down. All I'd like you to do, tell me that it isn't true.
If a song moves you, that's all that's important. So said Bob Dylan in his recent Nobel Prize lecture. But it's Dylan's profound and deeply poetic lyrics that set him apart from other aging rock and rollers. They've had a particular impact on Harvard Classics professor Richard Thomas. He says that Dylan's way with words puts him in the company of the great classic lyric poets like Homer and Virgil. This hour on Point, we're talking about the enduring poetic power of Bob Dylan. You can join us online or on air. What Dylan songs mean the most to you? Does he belong in the pantheon of the world's great classical poets? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now in the studio is Richard Thomas. He's a Dylanologist, a professor of classics at Harvard University. He's also author of Why Bob Dylan Matters, which was just released yesterday. You can find an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. And Richard Thomas, what a great pleasure to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Anthony. It's great to be here.
Nice to hear the song in the background. I feel like we should just listen to it for a moment.
Sure. Back to my 18th year.
Say again, this brings you back to...
My 18th year, 18 and 19.
That's great. Well, let me start with this question. Tell me your story of how Bob Dylan came into your life and why it has stayed there.
Yeah, so it was really from the beginning. I'm 9 years younger than Dylan, so when I was 13 and 14, I started hearing his songs and remember most... clearly, or the earliest memory is singing Blowin' in the Wind in my school choir. And so just the sense of sort of social justice, equality, the what was wrong with the world. This was, you know, Kennedy had been assassinated. And the song, of course, it predates that, but my hearing it in New Zealand. So that I then heard that song and other songs during the sort of fight against apartheid in New Zealand and Vietnam. So partly early on it was a protest and a social justice aspect of it, but really always beneath that was the artistic excellence of Dylan, and that's, you know, his basically his song that stayed with me.
Well, this you mentioned Blowin' in the Wind, and I want to talk about that song in particular. It'll always have a special place in the canon of Dylan's work. He wrote it as a 21-year-old, and it, as you suggested, it sort of became the anthem of the anti-Vietnam War generation. But the question it raises transcends any single time period. He's sung it more than 1,400 times. So let's listen to a little bit of Blowing in the Wind and then talk about it.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
The classic Blowing in the Wind from Bob Dylan. My guest is Richard F. Thomas, a Harvard classicist and author of Why Bob Dylan Matters. Let's talk about this song. Why does this song matter?
I think partly it's artistry. So that we have Three verses, each with three questions, each question extending over two lines, and each followed by the same answering couplet. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind, with the ambiguity of that, blowing where? Blowing to us, blowing away from us. So the questions, which are essential questions about equality, about peace, about when war will stop, and just see. But to me, it's the, now it's the artistry of it and not just the protest aspect. Dylan, when he first sang it, said, this here ain't a protest song or anything like that, because I don't write protest songs. I'm just writing it as something to be said for somebody, by somebody.
He was deeply uncomfortable with the idea that he was sort of labeled a spokesperson for a generation of protest, right?
Right, yeah. And Todd Gitlin said whether he liked it or not, Dylan sang for us. We followed his career as if he was singing our songs. And so Dylan, of course, apart from the March on Washington, didn't participate in the marches in which his songs were being sung by Baez and others.
Yeah. Richard Thomas, you know, you've been studying and then teaching the classics for 40 years, and you write that you've been living in the world of Bob Dylan for even longer than that. But what links Dylan to the worlds of Homer and Virgil and Horace and Ovid?
Right.
You write sort of beautifully about this.
Well, thanks. Yeah, the reason I got into those texts, those poets, is that they say at a sublime level what it means to be a human being. So they think our thoughts for us, but in artistic ways, but that matter in our lives. That's why they've survived over the years. And Dylan does the same. So Dylan happens to have been referring to reusing some of these texts. That's not why I think Dylan's great. I think Dylan is great because, like those poets, his aesthetics, his art, his poetry in song matter to those millions who follow him.
Yeah. Listeners, we're talking to Richard Thomas. He's author of Why Bob Dylan Matters. He's a Harvard classicist at Harvard University. He actually teaches a seminar to freshmen every 4 years on Dylan. Why does Dylan matter to you? What explains his longevity? What's your favorite Dylan song? What songs mean the most to you? Richard, I wanted to ask you about this seminar that you teach to students every 4 years at Harvard. How did this come about?
Yeah, it came about really, and I was chair of my department, and the dean wanted more freshman seminars offered, so I thought since I was chair, I would do one myself. I did one on poetic translation 1 year, then the next year, and particularly after hearing Love and Theft, 2001, and particularly Lonesome Day Blues, in which a couplet from the poet Virgil Anchises to his son Aeneas about what it means to be Roman, that Dylan is actually quoting from that in Lonesome Day Blues. So that got me sort of making that connection. I'd for 20 years or so connected Dylan particularly to the lyric poet Catullus. I think the young lyric Dylan is very much like the young Catullus, who dies young but expresses really similar sentiments around love, loss of a brother, the abandonment of him by his lover, and so very, very much like those themes in Dylan.
But when you proposed doing a seminar at Harvard on Bob Dylan, I gather the initial reaction, at least to some members of the faculty, not so positive.
I think one colleague, apparently on the, not departmental colleague, one colleague on the committee said, what's he going to do, sit around listening to Highway 61 with them? And, of course, the answer to that is yes.
Absolutely.
How could one not? But also discussing that great song and its great opening, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. And the fact that not just the Abraham of the Bible, but that Robert Zimmerman's father was Abraham as well. So the complexity right there in that opening couplet of that fantastic song.
Well, you do this seminar, and I understand it pretty much sells out, so to speak. It's oversubscribed is the better word every time. And I wanted to read from your book, because you included some some writings from your prospective students about why they wanted to take the Dylan seminar. I'm just going to read a couple. I want to take the seminar because I want to be a better writer. I want to analyze his lyrics and internalize the reason people empathize with his sentiment. Maybe I can't. Maybe it's innate. And then someone writes, I want to gain an understanding of how music can interact with history and philosophy. My favorite English teacher from high school loves Dylan. Anyway, lots of nice reasons, but that must have made you feel pretty good when you read those sorts of reasons.
Yeah. The first time I offered it, I had no idea who would apply for it. You know, 40 students, and it was more like 40. There are 12 slots, so you pick 12. I usually try and pick an assortment, some who know Dylan as well as I do, or better, even knowing the lyrics, having recall of the lyrics, some who know him a bit, some who are curious to find out about why their father has been listening or their grandfather has been listening to this stuff all their life. And by the end, they all have a greater appreciation of Dylan, not just by what I say, but what each of them says. We learn a lot from each other.
But what explains why there's so much interest among this generation in Dylan, who, you know, an aging rock and roller in his 70s? What explains that?
I think the songs, the music, the performance. So in performance, I usually go to 2 or 3 concerts a year, 4 or 5 in the last year or so. And you see a mix. It's mostly older people, but it's also people in their 40s who came on board, say, in the 80s, late 80s. So it's a whole range. And I think the ones who are coming on now, 5 years after the Tempest, are connecting with the list.
Right. Well, we're talking with Richard Thomas about why Bob Dylan continues to matter. His book is called Why Bob Dylan Matters. You can join the conversation. Have you seen Dylan on tour recently? What did you think? How does his work stand the test of time? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Do you want to make a deal?
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
If you see her, say hello. She might be in Tangier.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Bob Dylan's songs, the old, the new, and the ones that struck us most. This is If You See Her, Say Hello, from Dylan's 1975 album, Blood on the Tracks. The album is one of Dylan's best-selling of all time. And my guest today, Richard Thomas, a professor of classics at Harvard and author of the new book, Why Bob Dylan Matters. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Dylan's Christian phase? Or the allegations that Dylan plagiarized parts of his songs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Richard Thomas, we're listening to this wonderful song from Blood on the Tracks, really regarded as the pinnacle of his work, or at least one of his best albums of all times. Why? Talk a little bit about Blood on the Tracks.
Yeah, so it's a song, an album that Dylan has said, how can that be people's favorite album? It's full of pain, and I think that's part of it, that the pain of the poem presented in, again, such high artistic terms sort of allows us to empathize with it, because it sort of states our story too in many ways. So it's generally thought to be, you know, about the impending divorce. It's not final till 77, a couple of years after the album comes out. But that song, and that song, this album we have now with the Tulsa Archive, drafts of the song, but now it changes in performance, and that song in particular changed radically, so that the last line, which is sort of affectionate, becomes, if she's passing back this way and it couldn't be too quick, please don't mention her name to me. You mention her name, it just makes me sick. So that, from that, tell her she can look me up if she's got the time, which keeps open the option of a relationship versus a performed, that particular performed version, which closes it out pretty emphatically.
I want to play the first song from Blood on the Tracks, Tangled Up in Blue. In your book, you write about how Dylan's memoir faintly recalls his 1975 song, Tangled Up in Blue. So it's a breakup story. It's one of his most famous songs. Let's take a listen.
She lit a burner on the stove and offered me a pipe. I thought you'd never say hello. She said, you look like a silent type. She opened up a book of poems and handed it to me, written by an Italian poet from the 13th century. And every one of them words rang true and glowed like burning coal, pouring off of every page like it was written in my soul. But me to you,
Tangled Up in Blue, from Bob Dylan's great album Blood on the Tracks. Richard Thomas, you write that this song is often the only one he still plays in his live shows from the 1970s, right?
Right. Currently, it's the only one he's been playing on the tour, yes.
So why? Why does he hold on to this one, do you think?
Well, I have a view about the concerts that it's triadic. He's talked about this. So he's playing songs from the 60s, before Blonde on Blonde in 66. At the beginning, interspersed with the American standards that he's recorded and is now interleaving with his set list. And then, yeah, this song only in the middle section, and then a lot of the songs from Tempest in particular, fantastic songs, early Roman Kings, Pay in Blood in particular. And that basically a concert is Dylan's life or the career of his song. So I think that's partly it. And the arrangement of Tangled Up in Blue now is completely changed. I mean, a couple of weeks ago when I heard it, it was almost unrecognizable.
I want to ask you about that because, you know, as we listen to Tangled Up in Blue, I was 15 or 16 when this song came out, and I just remember this was the moment in my life where Bob Dylan just reached me, and I just got him, and I listened to this album obsessively. But I didn't stay an obsessive Bob Dylan fan. I mean, I have always revered him. I've always been happy that he's out there. But I've been to about 3 concerts in the last 10 years or so. And one of the things I'm troubled by is what he does to his old songs in his current performances.
Right. Well, it's...
Sometimes they're unrecognizable. Sometimes he's halfway into it and you suddenly realize, oh, he's doing that wonderful song that I used to listen to at a different time in a different way.
Yeah, well, I think his art right now has him interested in arrangements, working with his band, sort of very basically reaching out to other sort of styles. And of course, you know, song and memory are very sort of powerful companions, so that if you hear a song, as I did, I'm a bit older than you, but I heard this album and Tangled Up in Blue when I was in college, graduate school just beginning, and it meant a lot to me. It connected with my experiences. So when a singer changes that and upsets it, he's doing or she's doing damage to something that's very fundamental to your memory of what happened,
yeah,
at various parts of your life. So it's not that Dylan doesn't care about that, but that Dylan, the artist, is has moved on, and he's using these great lyrics with different arrangements, you know.
And I gather this means that there must be groups of Dylan fans who sort of relate to the Blood on the Tracks phase, or, you know, maybe his Christian music phase, or maybe what he's doing today. Or do you get the sense that the hardcore fan is there through all these phases?
I think a lot dropped out in 79 with the Christian phase, but we're now seeing what a fantastic phase that is in performance. I stopped listening a bit. I mean, I kept listening to the backlist, but it took me a while to see what those songs were. Partly I've since sort of have more of a faith than I had then, but so partly I was slightly offended, even as many were. But I think there have been some who have been together through life with him as he entitles the album a couple of albums ago.
We're going to talk about that Christian phase a little later in the hour, because I agree with you. There's some wonderful music that came out of that phase, and I had the same sort of reaction that you did. I sort of offended is the wrong word, but I lost interest, and then years later I sort of tuned back in and thought, wow. Let's take some callers. We're talking to Richard Thomas. He's author of Why Bob Dylan Matters. That's the question to you. Does Bob Dylan matter? If so, why? Talk about your experience with Bob Dylan songs and why they are still so meaningful. Let's go to Jeff, who's calling from Watertown, Mass. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi. Good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hi, Richard. I'm looking forward to getting this book. I also teach on the high school level. The two comments I wanted to make, one is his connection to the Odyssey. And in the beginning of the Scorsese movie, when he talks about, you know, never feeling at home growing up and not, you know, and always feeling he had to, you know, he had to go searching, finding that thing that Woody Guthrie brings him to New York City. But that is so much the Odyssey, you know, and he identified the Odyssey as one of the important works. And the other thing I always say about him is if you take the Highway 61 period, he's essentially Hamlet. He's Hamlet with a happy ending because he always comes out on top in those songs. But, you know, he has the same kinds of observations, the same kind of humor, the same disregard for, you know, custom. And, you know, and it's just the connections to Shakespeare are tremendous. I mean, you could do a whole volume on just Dylan and Shakespeare.
Yeah, Shakespeare in the Alley. Right.
Yeah. Jeff, I want to hear Richard's response to your question, but I'm just curious to ask you, as someone who teaches Dylan in high school, how do your students, how do your high school students relate to Bob Dylan?
When they focus on the lyrics, they are often very, very excited. Some of them, you know, classic rock, so some of them know the songs, and that makes it easier. But some are into, you know, pop and hip-hop and things like that. So it really is the lyrics that get them. Some of the sound can turn them off in the beginning. And you also often have to bring in, sometimes I'll bring in other singers' interpretations just so they can kind of hear the song in its full majesty. But they respond. They definitely respond to the lyrics. And I know, Richard, you made this point before, but for all of us who have been talking about his importance on a literary level, the Nobel Prize was just huge because, you know, we get the last laugh now.
Exactly, yeah.
It's hard to argue why are you teaching a Nobel Prize laureate. You know?
Right.
Yeah. Well, hard to argue with that. Yeah, go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I was teaching it on the day, of course, October 13th last year, of the announcement. And so that's really how the book came to be after the New York Times came to my classroom. Shakespeare in the acceptance speech, the Nobel acceptance speech, I have a whole chapter on all of the Nobel aspects, including the June 5th Nobel lecture, which is fantastic. I mean, absolute fantastic. And there, he picks out the Odyssey and he says he summarizes the Odyssey. He did this, he did that. And then he uses a second person. You too have been challenged. You too have slept with the wrong woman. You too have had drugs put in your wine. And he's talking about you, Bob Dylan, but he's also talking about you and me. And I think he connects there with Cavafi's poem Ithaca about how don't look to get to Ithaca too soon. Sort of it's a journey that matters. And I think he sees himself on the road, you know, never-ending tour, never-ending odyssey. I think that's – and through the lyrics, via the lyrics of quoting Odysseus, not Homer, just lines from Odysseus, I suggest that he's actually become Odysseus, just as he had in earlier songs become various characters in folk songs or whatever.
Mm. Well, let's hear a little bit more music. Speaking of classic allusions in Dylan's song, I want to play Changing of the Guards. It came out 16 years after Dylan's career began, and the song opens with the lyrics, 16 years, 16 banners united over the field. Let's give it a listen.
They shaved her.
Dylan's Changing of the Guards. Richard Thomas, you write that in interviews he denied the significance of the timing, but you also write about how this song invokes ancient Rome in a big way, right?
Yeah, Jupiter and Apollo are there, and of course, you know, that sort of whets one's appetite. It's only fairly recently when I was reading the book that it's been there in plain sight in the last two lyrics books, official lyrics books, a draft across from the text of it. And the draft says, I stared into the eyes, ages roll upon Jupiter and Apollo, midwives stroll between Jupiter and Apollo, struggling babes pass between the sheets, destiny's face, miraculous one-eyed glory. And so all of these words, ages roll, Jupiter, Apollo, midwives, babes, have to do with Virgil's fourth eclogue, so-called messianic one, about when a boy is born, we'll start getting back to the golden age. And Dylan's been connected to Golden Age, Iron Age, the Greco-Roman equivalent of the loss of Eden for years. His Rome conference in 2001 before Love and Theft came out, he talks about it, and the reporters don't get what he's talking about. But so 78, I think he actually was beginning to engage some of these classic texts. The final version of that song, which he himself has said it could be more than thousands of years old, dropped a lot of that terminology, but of course it's still a fantastic song. My favorite from that album. That album is a letting down slightly from the two that preceded it.
Let's go back to the phones. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Thomas. He's a Harvard classicist and he's author of Why Bob Dylan Matters. He puts him in the same company of classic lyric writers like Homer, like Horace, like Ovid, among others. So give us a call. Let us know what you think, what you hear in Bob Dylan's songs, and why you think he has endured the way he has. Let's go to Craig, who's calling from Gretna, Nebraska. Hi, Greg. Craig, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah,
Hi, Craig.
I just got a comment. I just missed the Vietnam War, but I was in the service, and I just seen how the troops were treated, and then I noticed that these wars are ruined now, and I've seen how when they troops are coming back, how they're being treated. And my song I connect with from Bob Dylan is Masters of War. I think it takes and it explains a whole lot of Vietnam and the wars we're in now.
Master of War, it's one of his great anthems. Richard Thomas, you want to talk a little bit about that song?
Yeah, it's a fantastic song. Sort of notoriously, he stole the melody from Gene Ritchie's song Notaman Town, which is a very old town, old song, and of course, you know, does that melody belong to anyone? But the song, I think, part of the power of the song, you know, which basically is not against the war; it's against those who profit from war, and because of whom the blood of the young basically flows out from their bodies and is buried in the mud. And so then the address to these warmongers is the most powerful thing. It's powerful, too, because it doesn't mention any war. It's really earlier, that it's before Vietnam started really heating up. And, he was playing it in 2003 before we went into Iraq, and it took on utterly the same meaning there. And so it's a song, as long as there are going to be wars, and there are going to be wars for as long as humans are around, It's a song that's going to work. It's about old men sending young men into battle. And in the Nobel lecture, he alludes to it. He doesn't mention it, but when he talks about his All Quiet on the Western Front being his favorite anti-war, if favorite's a word, novel, and how after that he didn't need to read another one. And that, of course, particularly his version of it where he addresses the young German whose life has been degraded and eventually ends with shrapnel in the head. So, you know, whether Dylan got the song from that novel or the novel led him to the song, he says it's a former, but he doesn't actually mention, as I say, Masters of War. But yeah, fantastic song that is around forever.
Well, we're going to be listening to a lot more Bob Dylan music in this hour. We're talking about Bob Dylan's Roman influences, creative genius, and why he should be placed alongside some of the great classic poets and storytellers. You can join the conversation with Richard Thomas, author of Why Bob Dylan Matters, by giving us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll go out with Not Dark Yet from Dylan's 1977 album, Time Out of Mind. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
It's not dark yet, but it's getting there. And I've been to London, and I've been to Gamery. I followed the river and I got to the sea. I've been down on the bottom of a world full of lies. I ain't looking for nothing in anyone's eyes. Sometimes my burden is more than I can bear. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there. Only one thing I did wrong. Stayed in Mississippi a day too long.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about Bob Dylan's lyrics, his songs, and his influence on our culture. My guest today, Richard Thomas, a Dylanologist and professor of classics at Harvard University. He's the author of a new book, which is just out yesterday, Why Bob Dylan Matters. We're listening now to Mississippi from Bob Dylan's 2001 album, Love and Theft. The album was released September 11th, 2001. You can join the conversation. What do you make of how Bob Dylan accepted his Nobel Prize? What's your question for Dylanologist Richard Thomas? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Richard Thomas, I want to ask you, as someone who has been a huge fan of Dylan, who's read deeply into the classics and found these classical references in Dylan's song, have you ever had occasion to talk to him?
No, I haven't. And I should say others have found that different people have found the allusions. I've found a few that hadn't been seen, but I think the book basically tries to engage on why Dylan is quoting rather than just sort of noting that he is. But no, I haven't met Bob. I know his manager, Jeff Rosen, and a number of people in his office, and it's, yeah. It's a wonderful group of people. But
would you, is it something that you would like to do?
Sure. Yeah. That's the old, what would you say? And, but no, I'd love to meet him. But, yeah.
Yeah. What would you ask him?
How he was doing, probably. I wouldn't ask him what
that song
Mississippi
means
or yeah. anything, because he doesn't do that. So,
yeah, talk about that. He really doesn't want to answer those questions, does he?
Yeah, I think the closest he came is, again, in this fantastic Nobel lecture that you can both hear with the light piano accompaniment on the web, and there's now also a nice little book of it. But So he talks about his influences, but and I think, like any poet, I mean, he does it, and it's for you to say how it works on you, and so I think the last thing he wants to do is sort of pin down any song to a single meaning, and you know, and start lecturing about it. I think that would be the last, very last thing that Dylan would be interested
right.
in doing.
Let's go to Bryn, is calling from Wellsboro, Pennsylvania. Hi, Bryn, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Bryn.
I'm 70. I was one who grew up with Bob Dylan songs, and also Judy Collins and Joan Baez and Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. But the song that really speaks to me even before this incident was The Times They Are Changing. And in June 1965, I attended a high school graduation, my cousin's class in Alexandria, Virginia. I think it was Holland Hills or Holland Hall High School. I'm not sure of the name. And the student speaker, the baccalaureate, used the theme, The Times They Are Changing, or used the song itself, The Times They Are Changing, for his speech to, you know, hundreds of people in a gym, not a gym, in an outside field, in a football or soccer stadium. And so we're all on bleachers. And as he gets into the line, don't stand in the doorway, don't block the hall, block up the hall, the adults in the crowd begin booing. This is Alexandria, Virginia, the home of the federal bureaucracy, and this is 1965. And shortly thereafter, the youth in the crowd begin cheering, and the speaker was at times almost drowned out, even over the amplification system, because the parents and the youth were trying to out-boo or out-cheer their children or their parents. It was the most graphic example that I've ever witnessed personally of the generation divide.
Yeah, in 1963 he wrote it, so in some ways before, as he and others have said, before the 60s start maybe around 63, 64 in that sense. But yeah, so he saw that the times were changing, but again, he puts it into this song, which is just so memorable. He sings it in England in 65 at the Pannebaker tour, and then he himself starts changing, you know, 2 years later in 65 when he goes electric, and the people who are standing in the doorway there are precisely Pete Seeger and the folk purists. And, you know, he begins every concert now with Things Have Changed, the song there, I Used to Care, But Things Have Changed. And that, I think, reflects, I'm getting a bit away from the fantastic description of the effect of the lyric of the song, but I think it does connect to this word change. So he sings the standard thing. Oh, I'm just blanking on the go away weekends, leave my key in the door, but why try to change me now? So that, you know, that's a cover, so called, but also it's about his changing.
Bryn, thanks so much for that great memory about Bob Dylan. We're talking to Richard Thomas. He's author of Why Bob Dylan Matters. Among other things, he writes, this is a book about how Dylan's genius has long been informed by the world of ancient Greece and Rome, and why the classics of those days matter to him and should matter to all of us interested in the humanities. Richard Thomas, I want to talk a little bit about Dylan's born-again Christian phase in 1979, and you write that he often preached about damnation and hellfire before launching into performances during this time. So let's start by listening to one of the songs from that period. It's a live performance of Precious Angel that took place in San Francisco in November of 1979.
And there's spiritual warfare, flesh and blood breaking down. Either got faith or you got unbelief, and there ain't no neutral ground. The enemy is subtle, albeit be deceived. When the truth's in our hearts and we still don't believe, shine your light. I'll make
Bob Dylan there with a live version of Precious Angel performing in San Francisco in 1979. Richard Thomas, you said that he gave some of the best live performances of his career in this period. And we mentioned earlier, it took me a while to sort of tune into this part of his career, but there's some great songs in this period.
Oh, yeah, and I'm firmly back with him, and particularly with the Trouble No More. You can get 8 or 2 CDs of that came out fairly recently, and I'm still working through that, including this song, which is a fantastic song. So it's clearly, you know, you were telling him about Buddha, you were telling him about Muhammad in the same breath. You never mentioned one time the man who came and died a criminal's death. So, you know, he's sort of right there with the crucifixion. Of course, Shelter from the Storm in 75 in a little hilltop village, they gambled for my clothes, where he's actually become sort of Christ there. So it's the song, the backup singers in live performance now. I mean, just in some ways, the studio versions were fine, even for those who stayed with him. But there's something about the performance, and Dylan, the performer, is always, I think, what is the most powerful aspect of him. Who is the sister? Who is the precious angel? It's a woman, or is it a woman? Is it a precious angel? Is it part of the whole process of what is either going on or of the creativity that he is applying to these songs in this period? So
he's just got this wonderful gospel thing going on here. Precious Angel by Bob Dylan there. Let's take some more calls. Jack is calling from Ashland, Wisconsin. Jack, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony and Richard. Good show. I just want to comment about what a multifaceted artist Bob Dylan is, and a comment, too, about his live performance. He's also a great, great painter, if anyone's seen any of his paintings.
Uh-huh.
And he made a great movie called Masked and Anonymous, which is almost prophetic, if you watch. Well, just like his songs. It's prophecy, almost. And then, you know, it's interesting to note how Bob's live act has evolved over the years. I mean, he went from being a guitar player to going to playing on the keyboard. Now he's doing he's singing the American Standards center stage, and his act's constantly evolving. He's creating live art. In fact, he's playing a show tonight in New York City at the Beacon Theater. I was fortunate enough to get to see him play in St. Paul, Minnesota with Mavis Staples is opening up the show on this tour.
Hmm.
And the act is constantly evolving. And, you know, he's a true live artist. A lot of people, they go and they expect to see him playing some kind of show that he did 30 years ago, and that's not what he does now. It's live art.
Jack, it's a great point. Richard Thomas, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely, Jack. And I saw him in Akron a couple of weeks ago, and I'll see him at the Beacon on Saturday. And it's just fantastic. I mean, and the move, yeah, from guitar to keyboard. So he hasn't played the guitar. He picked it up for a couple of shows. I write a bit about that in the book last tour. He plays the keyboard. Is it because he can't do the guitar, arthritis, or is it because he realizes that what he has in the three guitarists that he has currently, that he doesn't need to do the guitar? And so the center stage stuff works with the American Standards. It works with some of his own more melancholic songs, which are just fantastic. Mastered Anonymous is a masterpiece. I went the first week, and there were about 8 people in the theater, and it had closed by, I think, the second week. But I show it to my students, and I'm not sure they all agree that it's a masterpiece, but it's phenomenal.
I want to read a comment that we got on Facebook from 151945. I don't know that Dylan belongs in the company of the greatest poets, but not for lack of quality. The comparison is somewhat off because Dylan's work is inextricably bound to the music as well, and his genius delivery. He's one of the greatest singer-songwriter composers of all time, which is no less than one of the greatest poets of all time. The work may not stand up to the same level of scrutiny and genius without the music and the vocal delivery.
Yeah, so the Swedish Academy said, Sarah Danius, the permanent secretary, said, so Sappho was sung, we've lost the music, but you can read Sappho, and she's still poetry. So Bob Dylan, you can listen to his music, or you can read Bob Dylan, and it's still poetry. Dylan contradicted that in the Nobel lecture, where he did so in the following way. He said, my songs have to be sung. They're different from literature. So this was a speech in which he's accepting the Nobel Prize for Literature and says it's different from literature. So he was happy for the Nobel Committee to define what he did as literature if they wanted to, but he wasn't going to say you can read my song. So he's perfectly happy with that. So what is he in the genre song and dance man, he said, back in 65? So he's a poet who sings, but yeah, I agree absolutely that his the music is necessary to his particular sort of poetry.
Well, let's listen to a little more Dylan. I want to play some Lonesome Day Blues. In the book, you write how this song, you heard a clear evocation of a Virgil quote. So let's listen to a little bit of Lonesome Day Blues.
I'm going to stand at the defeated. I'm going to speak to the crowd. I'm going to stab the defeated, boys, I'm going to speak to the crowd. I'm going to teach peace to the conquered, I'm going to tame the proud.
Bob Dylan's Lonesome Day Blues off the 2001 album Love and Theft. So Richard Thomas, I'm going to spare the defeated. I'm going to speak to the crowd. I'm going to spare the defeated boys. I'm going to speak to the crowd. I'm going to teach peace to the conquered. I'm going to tame the proud. And you hear Virgil in that. Right?
Yeah, so Virgil in the Aeneid. Remember, Roman, these will be your arts, to teach the ways of peace to those you conquer, to spare defeated peoples, tame the proud. So it's Mandelbaum's translation from 1970, probably the most popular one, and Dylan saw it. So this is a song on which we have Saga, the Confessions of a Yakuza, talking about the Sino-Japanese War in the 30s. We have Huck Finn talking about feuds, the Shepherdson and so on. And the voice you think is a Vietnam voice, you know, the war, brother got killed in the war. But I think, like Masters of War, it's about any war. And I think the way Dylan is making it about any war in the music since, in this song, music since 2001, is by invoking these literary references. And if you see them, you see Roman Civil War, American Civil War, Chinese, Japanese War, and Vietnam, if you like. So that, I would say, is a function of those intertexts, as we call them.
Well, Richard Thomas, this has been such a pleasure. I could talk to you all day about why Bob Dylan matters and these deep allusions that you've dug up and talked about and the importance of Bob Dylan. Thank you so much for coming in. I'm really grateful.
Thanks, Anthony. It's been great being on.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. We'll go out with Highlands from Bob Dylan's 1997 album, Time Out of Mind. And have a great Thanksgiving holiday. Be safe. Be happy. We'll talk to you soon. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
What would I do with it anyway? Maybe take it to the pawn shop. My heart's in the highlands. Break of dawn by the beautiful lake of the black swan. Big white clouds like chariots that swing down.